A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast on The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week we talk comedy, tech, and why we need a party of fruitcakes and nutters. First, last week we asked you to post reviews on iTunes telling us where you're listening to the podcast. So hello to Dougsy, who's listening in Japan, Tom Platzi, who listens to Red Box on his sunny veranda in Rajasthan, and also hello to the person who said they listened to the podcast on their commute to Liverpool Street. Slightly less glamorous, but you're also welcome. Joining me this week, the only three people in the country who it seems haven't resigned as a frontbench spokesman for UKIP. Matthew Moore, the Times media correspondent, asks why all the jokes are on the left. Polly McKenzie, former Lib Dem Downing Street policy chief and new head of the Demos think tank on regulating the future. But first, Times columnist Matthew Paris on the slow death of a political party.
I never thought I'd say this, but I'm actually missing UKIP. I know there's this idiotic apology for a remnant of UKIP still there. What's his name? Bolton, and whoever Bolton's girlfriend or ex-girlfriend is or was. But they're no threat. Real UKIP was a threat. We need a nasty, credible right-wing party for stick-in-a-muds and slightly nutty people to vote for. At the moment, the Tories are occupying this slot, alas.
So it's been the sort of fun, most fun, if least consequential political story of the week is the demise, it seems, of UKIP. Henry Bolton clinging on to whatever it is that he's clinging on to. It's not totally clear.
Maybe his girlfriend now. And then Meghan Markle comes into it, but I can't remember.
It's because the girlfriend was racist about Meghan Markle.
Yes,
just to really unite. All UKIP stories have to involve the royals in the end.
But I do think the audience is wandering away. And we've got to have a right-wing party, and I'd always hoped it wouldn't be my own party, the Conservative Party. We're kind of moving in to fill that gap. I don't like it.
As we sort of maybe read the last rites for UKIP, do you think the influence that people ascribe to it is right, or is it overblown because Nigel Farage was such a good sort of PR man for himself in the party?
I don't think it has any influence at all now, except to discredit whatever it touches, but it did have influence, and you could argue that Brexit is Nigel Farage's personal work. In a way, it was. And I, at the time, used to worry about Conservatives leaving the party and joining UKIP. But now I've realised they've all come back again, and we're the worse for it. I think that Britain actually does need, to be semi-serious for a moment, Britain does need a proper, rather nationalist, seriously right-wing political party. And I don't think that's most of the Conservative Party, but it's some of us. And it would be better if someone could set up a respectable right-of-centre party and leave sensible Conservatives to be centrists.
And so that was a role that was carried out by the BNP before they sort of died away, and UKIP seemed to hoover a lot of them up.
Yeah, but the BNP was never taken seriously. UKIP was taken quite seriously, and indeed made serious dents into Conservative support. I saw it, or see it now, as a kind of, like you put a poultice onto a festering wound to draw off the sepsis. And I felt that UKIP was performing that useful role for the Conservative Party, and it's not there any longer.
So Polly, as a Lib Dem, do you mourn the demise of UKIP?
I think Matthew's got a point, really, of what the demise of UKIP is doing to the Conservative Party, except that it's actually a deliberate strategy by the Conservative Party to move into that space. You know, Theresa May could have adopted a different approach on Brexit that wasn't, you know, this red, white and blue Brexit, that tried to appeal to centrists. But she made a really deliberate decision to actually be offensive to anybody who voted Remain and anybody who might have considered themselves even right of centre and certainly left of centre. She's pulling herself over to the right to try and take those votes, because there was this electoral consideration, particularly in 2015, that was the way for the Conservatives to get a majority. It worked in 2015, didn't work in 2017, was to destroy UKIP and adopt them. And what troubles me as a centrist, a moderate, is that over on the left, the same has happened again, which is that the leadership have taken a deliberate decision to stretch as far to the left as they possibly can. I mean, what's the point in even being a member of the Socialist Workers Party these days when you've got Jeremy Corbyn in charge? And you just have this gaping maw where in the middle, everyone just looks a bit hopeless, desperate and short of ideas.
I'd never use the word deliberate strategy and Conservative Party in the same sentence, I must say. But
and just on your time, because the rise of UKIP and its popularity when it won the European elections in 2014, got 4 million votes in 2015, it did coincide with the dramatic collapse in support for the Lib Dems. And although on Europe you also take completely different views, there was this sort of sense that one was replacing the other as the sort of the container of the disaffected and the protest
vote. I'm sure that that's true. Because, like you say, the disaffected, the protest vote, the we just hate this system, we want something to change, anybody but the establishment. And for a long time, the Liberal Democrats, because they hadn't been in government for 50 or 80 years, depending on how you count, could absorb all of that sort of none of the above sentiment. And by campaigning locally, you know, whether it was in Colchester about, you know, bollards in Colchester or bollards in Falmouth, that is how Liberal Democrats campaigned. And UKIP could absorb that once the Liberal Democrats, by going into government, just became, in many ways, another face of the establishment.
Matt, to what extent do you think that this UKIP story is just the lobby having like one last bender on this circus, if you can have benders at circuses, before, you know, to the total disinterest of any normal person looking in?
I think everyone enjoys this theatre. There's something very human about this tragedy with the girlfriend and the ex-wife and the middle-aged man. I wonder whether sort of this is how all populist movements end up, because you look in the US where Bannon, sort of who's Farage's equivalent, had his moment in the sun, backed the right horse, got into the White House, left very quickly, insulted Trump, and has become now a sort of marginal, peripheral, slightly tragic figure. And it's the one thing that does kill off populist movements is when they get their way, they get into power, they win a referendum. Where do you go next with that anger? Where do you, when it dissipates?
Do you know, you're absolutely right. I'm just thinking, the Peronists in Argentina, and it all ended up with Eva Peron and all that kind of stuff. The Progressive Party in Denmark, Mogens Glistrup, all ended up with him becoming a comedy figure. You're right.
Well, and where is this now the start of a new era of moderation and centrism again? Is this burst that happened in the world, across the world, over the last 3 years, this populist surge, are we now beginning to see it recede? Are normal politics going to begin again soon? Possibly, I don't know.
There's also what happens when, because populism is by its very nature often very simplistic, we'll just do it and it's all going to be great. And what Trump has found in America is it's not, you know, running the country is a bit more complicated than that. You can't just get what he wants through the Senate. And in the same way that Brexit turns out to be much more complicated than we were necessarily led to believe, you know, Five Star in Italy has had similar problems when it starts having to do things in reality. That Polly, running a government is complicated, as the Lib Dems found.
Yes, it's incredibly complicated. And when you have overpromised, as some might argue the Lib Dems did in 2010, and then you underdeliver, the question is, what does that do to sentiment? Because I think it's absolutely right that populists lose their charm and their sparkle once they go into government. Do people sort of wise up and say, oh yeah, I should have voted for those people who said it was complicated? Or does it get worse? Do people mm-hmm. get more and more angry? You know, one of my biggest concerns about Brexit is that we've just got to this point where it might not be a disaster at best. Instead of, we were promised sunlit uplands and all of this money and that the NHS would be filled and there wouldn't be any crime anymore. And surely people are going to be furious when eventually that dawning realisation that none of that good stuff is happening. The question is, where does that anger go? Does it go to moderation? I hope so. But I fear that it might go to more populism because the centrists, the moderates, haven't got much to say for themselves yet.
I have to say, I think that things would be different. And the trouble is, there isn't an obvious actual candidate. But if the current Prime Minister was a Leaver who did talk the message of sunlit uplands instead of this sort of moderating between Hammond and Boris all the time. It's just a great big bureaucratic exercise. It might slightly change the mood. But anyway, before we move on, does anyone want to pick their favourite UKIP, if we are calling the demise of UKIP? Hugo Rifkin's written in the Times this week an absolutely terrific column, taken up almost entirely with a list of their greatest hits, whether it's the guy who ran for the leadership who thought his horse had been raped by a gay donkey. Paul Nuttall alone, I declared in the Red Box politician as the hero of the year just before Christmas because of his... Well, partly because he helped bring about the demise of UKIP, but also his ability to keep on just creating news, not least with his CV and making up that he'd lost people at Hillsborough. And then when he was caught out with that, he went on TV and said, well, I've not been caught in a paedophile gang or anything. So has anybody got any particular UKIP favourite moments?
That moment when Farage resigned because he'd promised to and then unresigned about 3.5 minutes later, for me, just exposed that he's just a charlatan and he's all in it for himself.
The UKIP Calypso, do you remember?
The UKIP Calypso, I do remember.
And that's where the £350 million for the NHS first gained prominence.
Is it?
Yes, yes.
This is Mike Reed, the former DJ, recorded a song about UKIP in a Caribbean accent.
That's right, yes, and they had to drop it quickly.
Leaders committed a cardinal sin. Open the borders, let them all come in. Illegal immigrants in every town. Stand up and be counted, Blair and Brown. Oh yes, when we take charge and the new Prime Minister is Farage, we can trade with the world again. When Nigel is at number 10.
And so finally, Matt.
Well, it's not been not a funny one so much, but I think the fact of Farage being photographed going into the Ecuadorian embassy a year ago, whenever it was, I think that ultimately might turn out to be one of the most interesting things about UKIP over the last few years. What happened there? What conduit he provided? So that's something I'd be interested to read more about.
And that is where Nigel Farage becoming a person of interest in the Russia probe.
You don't think he might become an asylum seeker and take refuge?
Well, Farage?
Yes.
You've got a whole...
Oh, please, let's lock him in the Ecuadorian embassy. Fun.
You know that if he did, he'd make sure he had an ISDN line so he could still do endless appearances on LBC and the Today programme. I do thoroughly recommend Hugo Rifkin's piece because it is particularly good. It's got women as sluts for not cleaning behind the fridge, Bongo Bongo Land, Neil Hamilton blaming gays for floods, but people selling gollywogs in shops, all of it. It's well worth a look. Normally I would say, well, I'm sure it's an issue we'll come back to, but this might be the last time we ever discuss UKIP until Henry Bolton is in here doing an interview about his racist girlfriend. Right, let's move on, and this is Polly McKenzie.
Technology and how to regulate it is dominating more and more of our political debate, but it seems to me that whether it's Bitcoin, encryption, facial recognition or machine learning, most of our politicians are actually flying blind. And that's a huge risk that could land us just as easily with too little regulation as too much.
It does feel like this is one of these massive issues which is emerging with AI and artificial intelligence and robots and all that. But we're not talking about it because we spend all of our time talking about...
Henry Bolton.
Henry Bolton and Brexit, I was going to talk about.
Oh, yes, that
Interestingly,
too.
We're told that when Theresa May goes to Davos later this week, she's going to talk about the ethics of AI and robots.
Just so she doesn't have to talk about anything else, isn't it?
They've got that, they've crossed everything else off. If it wasn't that, she was going to talk about the weather. What do you think, Polly, that politicians should be doing?
Well, and actually, it's not just politicians. I think there's this huge gap that has opened up between politicians on one side and technologists on the other. If you think back to when Amber Rudd sort of had a go at encryption and then everyone just sort of laughed at her because she used as WhatsApps herself. And the technologists all just sort of laughed at her and pilloried her for not really understanding what she was talking about. Instead of actually accepting that they're doing stuff which, at a certain level, they barely understand. they need to explain and go through the process of educating our politicians. Because when politicians lash out against new technologies without really understanding how they work, they can cause serious harm. Demos launched last night, the first in a kind of series of technology education projects that that we're doing, starting with looking at child sexual abuse images and how they're shared online. Because, you know, you will so often hear politicians saying that YouTube or Google or Facebook ought to do this, that and the other, without taking the time to understand what the technology is capable of. You know, the vast volumes of data that's uploaded, exactly how technology can spot things that are child sex abuse or Islamic State terrorism and filter them. And I think we just need to bridge this gap and get people together instead of, on the one side, the politicians saying it is the end of day, social media is the cause of all harm, it's the cause of all misery, and we'll all just, you know, they're a bunch of tax evaders. And on the other hand, the technologists saying politicians are stupid, so we're just going to ignore you.
The politicians ever understand really what they're talking about? They can't really be experts.
I guess, you know, they're not experts.
They talk about agriculture and they don't know much about that. They talk about science and don't know much about that. They're supposed to be generalists. And I would have thought that the danger is of doing what you suggested at the outset, which is trying to legislate at this point for an emerging technology, particularly artificial intelligence, where we simply don't know what's going to happen or where it's going to go. I think we ought to just kind of sit back and let it all wash over. Let's see what happens.
Well, I think politicians aren't necessarily very good at that.
Mm.
And they see harm. You know, we have this massive rise in anxiety among young women. We have a massive rise in the use of social media by young women. And lots of people instantly turn to a belief that the two are causally linked rather than necessarily just correlated. When there are women increasingly self-harming, and we do need to consider how we take action, but without investing in the research and the understanding of what that causal pathway might be, the politicians will just turn to regulation.
I think there's a big debate now in the media sector about whether the tech giants like Google and Facebook and Twitter should be reclassified from platforms to publishers, making them take greater responsibility for their own content in the way that Channel 4 or the BBC or the Times has to. And that idea is sort of in vogue at the moment. There's lots of politicians calling for it. But I think there's like an emerging opinion is that these companies are not platforms, that's correct, but they're not really publishers in the way we understand that either. There's something in the middle that requires a new specific law and quite detailed understanding of what exactly it is these companies do, the threats they pose, and how that's best restricted. And it's difficult to see whether the government has the intellectual headspace to deal with that at the moment, because these are forensically difficult problems. And with Brexit, it's not the focus of the government when perhaps it should be.
There was a story in The Sun yesterday where they'd done some mystery shopping, basically, and shown that, you know, you could have up to 50% increase in your insurance premiums if your name was Mohammed. I haven't looked at their research methodology, but it's fascinating to see how algorithms are driving decisions. And there are other countries in which those algorithms have to be submitted to regulators and they have to be transparent. We don't have any ability to even see kind of under the hood of the car in order to actually educate the politicians. And of course, because it won't be the politicians who have the most detailed understanding, the regulators, the civil servants who are putting the proposals upwards.
There's also an issue as well, isn't there, Matt, where this sort of Silicon Valley mindset is that they are transnational. They don't answer to any particular government. Mm-hmm. They are new. As a result, politicians are a bit nervous, or they have been up until quite recently, about sort of being seen to criticise them, because they, you know, they're trendy people on hoverboards in open plan offices and all that sort of thing. And I mean, I know, even as a journalist, if you want to get a quote from Facebook or Google or Amazon, you can't find a phone number or an email address like you could for a bank or a supermarket or whatever, because they feel that they're
3 or 4 years ago, these organisations were entirely opaque to much of the population, which worked in their favour. They were seen as they had the magic recipe, the magic sauce. They knew what they were doing, a grand vision that would help everyone. And media coverage of the tech giants 5 years ago was hugely positive. People thought they sort of had the solutions to so many of the world's problems. Now it's gone entirely the other way. People are critical and sceptical. And there's a big difference in how these companies are engaging. Google in particular has been more willing to admit its errors, more willing to describe exactly what it's doing and brief journalists on that detail. Facebook and Twitter are much more opaque organisations still. Legislators on both sides of the Atlantic have struggled to get them to engage with issues around fake news and dubious content. And we've seen last week Facebook said it's going to respond to the fake news row by basically giving readers and users less news, giving them more cat photos and holiday photos instead, which seems like a retreat rather than engagement.
I think it's probably just an acceptance of what's happening. What we haven't talked about here is the ordinary public's attitude to these media platforms, and there's plenty of evidence that people are beginning to think that you can't believe what you read on social media. You can't believe what you read on Facebook. That is the best antidote in the end. The public just get wise to stuff.
And actually, there was an Edelman Trust performance about just this week, which showed exactly that. It was about a quarter of people said they trusted what they read on social media.
Yeah, and just I think this 24% of people now trust the tech giants, and respect for traditional media has increased as people look for reliable brands like the Times.
But then your point, Polly, is this isn't just about what we see as sort of social media companies. Is that every business now has a website, and they are using tech to target customers, to inform decisions, you know, through AI or through algorithms or whatever. And if we don't know what they're doing, for some people, then they then feel there's a need for the government to step in.
Well, it's massive in insurance, where we don't really understand how insurance decisions are made. But it's also, you know, Bitcoin and, you know, the Bitcoin bubble, and it's facial recognition technology, which, you know, is being used in China, we know, and is probably has the capability to be used here to really spot you where you are in the street based on the biometrics that you've submitted. And I don't think anybody's really understanding how far we could be in 5 years and where the regulators need to even just start a conversation.
One of my favourite stories of this week was the shop which had a robot which stood by the door to welcome people in and the hope of increasing custom. And it proved very popular to start with. And then for some reason they got it to start handing out meat. And it turned out that people were less willing to take pulled pork from a robot than they were from a real person. So the robot's been fired. It's been set in the back of the shop. So I don't know what that means.
It's a measure of how our attitudes are changing. That when I read that story this morning, I felt just for a moment a twinge of sympathy for the robot and thought, poor robot, it wasn't its fault. And then I had to remind myself, no, Matthew, it's a robot.
But I think the flaw in that plan was that people don't like being handed meat when they walk into a shop by anyone.
Was it a meat shop?
I don't think it's like a sort of department store, I think. Oh.
How are you supposed to take the meat? Are you handed the pork?
I wonder if they would have trusted a table.
I just don't think people want to have meat thrust upon them in shops.
I'm a big one for free samples.
I'm anti-meat. I think it's the meat fault, not the robot's fault. I feel like we've cleared that one up. In a moment, we'll be talking about why are there no right-wing comics. We'll be back after this short break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Times Red Box podcast. I'm joined by Polly McKenzie, Matthew Paris, and this is Matt Moore.
Are Donald Trump jokes starting to wear thin? Do satirists give David Davis a harder time than Guy Verhofstadt? That's the view of the founders of a new free-thinking comedy night intended as an antidote to the liberal and left-wing humour of Radio 4 panel shows. But can right-wing comedy really be funny? And do all taboos really need to be shattered?
Now, I find this really interesting. In the past, we've done some comedy specials on the podcast. We've had comedians on where they talk about it, about the natural inclination of comedians and why that happens. So it was interesting. You wrote about this in the Times last week, this comedy night that's launched.
Yeah, so it's launching next month, actually, in the East End at the Backyard Comedy Club. And the idea behind it, just a comedian and a writer have come up with it, is that orthodox, mainstream, liberal comedy that you hear on Radio 4 or you go to on the stand-up comedy circuit comes with a set of assumptions, and they are that Donald Trump is an idiot, that Brexit is bad and being bungled, and that Daily Mail readers or Daily Mail ideas are inherently laughable. And I think they're probably correct in that diagnosis. If you listen to Radio 4 panel shows and you hold some of those opinions, it's probably quite an unwelcoming place. The danger is, though, that a show that is set up just to provoke could become very dreary or very adolescent quite quickly. So they now need to prove that unorthodox, anti-PC, challenging comedians can be funny without being tedious.
I'm not sure that it's a left-wing, right-wing thing. I wonder whether it isn't just that losers always have the best jokes, and it isn't so easy for winners to have the best jokes. I mean, Donald Trump is president of the United States. We are leaving the European Union. It's great railing against those things.
Well, I think this is the question. The best comedy punches up, but now it's hard to know where up is. So
yeah.
Trump and May, they are our leaders. They are the ones the satire would seem to direct us to mock. However, the people behind this club night would argue that the cultural power is held by middle-class, metropolitan, Guardian reading liberals who work at the BBC, and actually that's the cultural force in Britain that we need to be satirising. And I think that will ring true with a lot of people who hold maybe slightly right-of-centre views and don't feel that there is currently a place for them in the comedy circuit.
I don't think Matthew's hypothesis is... quite holds water, because if you could only punch up, there would be a lot more women stand-up comedians. You know, women are historically the marginalised gender, and women don't seem to be able to make it in stand-up comedy anywhere near as many numbers as they should.
Maybe
do.
They aren't very good at it.
Maybe that's the case.
But do you think there was an interesting study that we had last week or the week before in Redbox about people who have political ambition and who were more likely to put themselves forward as a candidate? And men were much more likely to put themselves forward. Well-off, middle-class, white men were much more likely to put themselves forward than any other group. And so then that's a real challenge then to people who rightly say, well, we do need more women in politics, or, you know, we should have more women in comedy. But there are just few. I just know more blokes who are show-offs, of which I'd probably include myself in there.
Yeah,
who would put themselves forward to be comedians.
Well, so it may also be the case then that just left-wing people are more funny. Maybe right-wing people who, either because they're successful investment bankers, the last thing they want to do is schlep around to Leicester on the stand-up circuit, or because they're just hateful people who like to persecute disabled and black people, I don't know, they're just not very funny.
On your point about women, Shirley Williams once told me that years ago, when she, Shirley, was a minister, she was in the ladies' sitting room at the House of Commons with Margaret Thatcher, who was also on her way up, but not up. And Margaret Thatcher congratulated her on her speech, and she said, thank you. And Margaret said, we must never let them win. And Shirley said, what do you mean? And she said, men. She said, to men, politics is a game. To us, it is destiny. And perhaps there is just an intrinsically more serious-minded approach to politics and public affairs by women than there is by men. We do see it as a bit of a game sometimes.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's really very funny, as Henry Bolton, just to bring us back to the beginning. But, you know, we see Ayesha Hazarika, who has done a brilliant job, I think, kind of launching herself out, you know, mocking and lampooning, not just right of centre opinions, but actually also the existence of the Labour Party, all the ridiculous experiences that she had operating with the pink bus. And I think there is something inherently mockable about all of the institutions of political power.
One thing, I mean, I find, particularly when I'm writing whether it's my Saturday column or writing the Redbox email in the morning, I don't have a particular problem with finding funny ways of taking the mickey out of Jeremy Corbyn or Tim Farron or Vince Cable. But because the country is being run by the right at the moment, you end up, in the same way that political journalists write about them more, they do more stuff, which is noticed by more people, so it's easier to sort of send them up.
I think there's certainly some truth to that, but I think they're possibly are individuals and groups within our politics that don't get the skewering that Theresa May or David Davis or Boris Johnson get. The one point that people behind this comedy night made was that Guy Verhofstadt, Michael Barnier, Donald Tusk are very funny people, potentially. There's a lot of material there. Verhofstadt is an eccentric, interesting man who likes classic car riding and is not unopposed to the sound of his own voice. And it's harder to get a laugh about him than the reflexive laugh that you get if you make a joke
because
about
Trump. Because people don't know any of that.
Who he is.
I mean, but that's practically one. News to me, and I'm looking at my feet. You know, that's why. It's because it's so much easier to mock people who are familiar to your audience.
Although it's interesting, when we had Jan Ravens on last summer, who does terrific Diane Abbott and Theresa May impressions on Dead Ringers and that sort of thing, and she said she wanted to do a sketch about Christine Lagarde and was told by a producer, no, we can't do that, you know, Beryl in Barnsley won't know who Christine Lagarde is. And she said, well, that's part of our job. If you're doing satire, you have to, or, you know, there's an element of education and introducing people to those things. And I'm still not convinced about a comedy night where Guy Verhofstadt is the sort of main...
I want to hear a joke about Malala. I want to hear a joke about people who have such a saintly reputation that you don't actually sort of get the chance to...
What point... I take your point, and I think a good joke is a good joke, and it can be about anyone. The danger is that when people say, oh, you know, we need a counterbalance to the left, what they mean is actually it ends up being jokes about disabled people or race, or and it's just offensive for the sake of it.
OK, but Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell are absolutely ripe for satirising, and there isn't an awful lot of it at the moment.
I think a few years ago, Alan Corran was that voice on radio. He provided the curmudgeonly but humane right of centre, the man who was slightly fed up with the way the world was going, but still sort of loved everyone in it. And I don't think such a voice has emerged yet. Simon Evans is one name that the BBC point to as a regular panel show guest who is not from sort of the liberal orthodox position. Our own Hugo Rifkind has been on these shows before. So there are a diverse range of voices, but there's probably more that can be done.
Well, it's interesting. I look forward to finding out what this Guy Verhofstadt joke is. It's going to bring...
That could be a...
It's going to be... Maybe if anybody's got a Guy Verhofstadt joke...
Got to have a prize
then,
for best.
Then send it in, redbox@thetimes.co.uk. I've got one or two Redbox mugs left, so if anybody can come up with a good Guy Verhofstadt joke, I'll share it with you next week, and the winner can get a Redbox mug. Huge thanks to my guests. As ever, like I said, do get in touch with us. You can also tweet us at TimesRedbox. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and post a review there. Tell us where you're listening. And sign up to my morning email briefing. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Polly McKenzie, Matthew Paris, Matthew Moore, and me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.